folks.
Oh.
I mean, our note taker folks.
Yes.
Great. If you could please note who all's here, both in terms of the 12 official members of this committee, and then with the people who are on by phone, please identify yourself both by the last four digits of your phone number and who you are.
Do we want to, Virginia, would it be, yes. I'm not sure how many people are going to join. Do we want to make sure we capture whenever anyone participate, you know, speaks, that we get their name?
Sure. That would certainly help.
Yeah. And as usual, you've got me up top, it looks like, but then also I'm on my phone. So my number is the 6980.
6980 is Dave. Okay. Who is 4112?
Hello, this is Kevin Blue with the DPH.
Thank you. And who is 3417?
S. Abby, DPH.
What other numbers do we have?
8003.
And that's Bruce Wichen at OPM.
Oh, hey, Bruce.
Hi.
Okay, I think that's it. Do we have a quorum? Let's see. We've got Lou, we've got Mike, we've got Corinne, we've got
you,
me, Steve. And Dave, we've got at least six.
I may or may not be Steve, though. He looks like he's in an interview where they're trying to preserve his identity there.
And we've got Tom. Now we've got it. I count at least eight, so we're good in that sense. Okay, so let's get going. Welcome to all the public folks, the non-committee folks who have joined us. Appreciate your interest and your attendance. So starting off with the routine stuff, hope you're all doing well and continuing to survive under these circumstances. I think it's really great that we can get together via Zoom. You all got the notes from the May 19th meeting. Was there anything that you noticed that needs to be corrected in those notes? Hearing none, could I have a motion to approve those notes?
I'll make a motion to approve.
Any second? Was that your pencil going up, Karen? But you're not a committee member.
I will second.
Great. Okay. Any I guess I should say everybody in favor, say aye, or wave your hand, or just don't say no. And if there are any no's, state them explicitly, or abstentions. Okay, well, so then they are available to be posted for all to see. So are there any changes to the agenda that you can see that you want to propose? Nope. Moving right along, Mary Ann, you have a update for us and a PowerPoint, I understand, and also would you introduce your team members to...
Yes. Joining me on this call is Bill Christensen, our Director of Programs at the Alliance for Water Efficiency, and Lacey Smith, who is a program planner with us at the Alliance for Water Efficiency. And both of them worked on the state laws presentation that we're going to make to you today, and will be helping me answer questions and provide additional detail.
Great. And do either of you, Lacey or Bill, do you have video possibilities so that we can see you and attach a face to the person?
I do not. This is Bill. I do not have video capabilities this morning.
Okay. How about you, Lacey?
Fair, everyone.
There you are. Okay.
There she is.
Glad to see your face and to know you. So, Marianne, the floor is yours.
Okay. So, can I share my screen? Is that something I can do here? Do you all see?
You should be able to. Yep.
Okay. So, do you all see my? See the slide? Is all coming through all right? Okay, so I will first apologize. I have allergies, and this must be a particularly bad pollen day in Chicago because I'm coughing and blowing my nose a lot. So I apologize if that happens during this presentation. I do not have COVID. This is allergy driven. So apologize for that in advance. So we wanted to give you a short update today and talk with you about some next steps. And the first thing we wanted to first bring up is the progress we're making on putting together the rates workshop in March. Thanks to the little planning task group that's working with me, you know, Dave, Virginia, Alicia, and Steve. So they're working with me to make sure that what we put together in this workshop is responsive to what you need in Connecticut. You've decided, I think, at the Water Planning Council meeting to have the rates workshop be an in-person workshop rather than a virtual one. So we're going to postpone it to March of next year with the hopes that that will allow us to once again have meetings in person. It's an all-day workshop. Time frame is 9 to 3. We'll serve lunch.
Right.
And thanks to Tom, we have confirmed that we will have it at the MDC Training Center. And we have reserved the date with him of March 18th. That's a day when Jan Beecher is actually going to be in Connecticut during that period of time. So we needed to take advantage of the fact that she will also, you know, be close by and able to participate in person in the workshop. And what we want to focus on in this workshop is how to align a water efficiency-oriented rate structure with the need for revenue stability at the utility level. So that remains the basic focus that we want to try to put forth in this workshop. As I mentioned, Jan Beecher will be one of our speakers, and she's going to talk about the options for revenue adjustment mechanisms in municipal systems. And she's done a lot of work in this area, so we're very happy that she's made this time available to us to do this. And we'll have materials that she will prepare. We'll have handouts. We'll have, you know, folders with lots of material and for the attendees and participants. we are seeking a municipal utility for being a case study for our rate model. We'll be modeling their existing rate structure as well as a proposed scenario rate structure. And we're also looking for local officials who would like to participate in a panel discussion on how to get to yes on troublesome rate matters and how to deal with the issues that are always cropping up when it comes to public approval of rate structures and changes in rates. So that's the update of where we are at present. The little task group is working with me to make sure we have the right invitation list, that we have the right speakers. And so we'll be sharing with you the agenda as it comes together at future meetings.
Excuse me, Marianne, are you going to be saying more about the workshop and further along in this presentation?
No, I was just going to also just show you one more slide of the kinds of materials we will make available at the workshop. So we'll have a handout. There'll be a handbook that we'll be giving participants. We'll be giving them access to our sales forecasting and rate model and conducting a training session using the case study and how that works. And we'll also be featuring our consumer messaging and a number of other resources that are on the Financing Sustainable Water website. So that's part of what we'll be covering in the workshop.
What I wanted to say was for those people who either are in the industry or have connections with the industry, just wanted to point out in our search for a utility that was willing to share their data and be the case study, if that utility wanted to remain anonymous, they certainly could.
Yes, that's right. Thank you for saying that. We're happy to daylight the utility or not, but we would like to base it on a real utility. We can also, you know, fictionalize one, but it's much better to actually have a real example. So we're looking for that. And Bill, who is on the call, is the modeler who will be putting together that rate structure, the rate model analysis. So if you have any questions about that, he's on the call as well.
And okay. This is Dave. Just one more thing, Marianne, just so everyone who's on the call knows that you had sent out an example, you and Bill sent out an example of the types of data that will be needed from hopefully someone who is willing to share that. So we'll make that available. You can see it's pretty basic stuff. And it really, for a medium-sized utility, it shouldn't be that hard to pull the data together.
Yeah, the hardest part is the bill tabulation, but if a utility has already done one, then it'll be a lot easier to get the rest of the data. Okay, so what we wanted to focus on, I know you have a very busy agenda, we have lots to cover, so we didn't want to take up the entire time, but we wanted to give you a snapshot of some of the options we are looking at for state policy changes in Connecticut. And we wanted to frame it as open options because what we'd like to do, and we'll explain at the end of the presentation, is we'd like to get your feedback on which ones you think are appropriate for the state. So we'll go through them here. First of all, we wanted to tear it off of what you already have in the Connecticut Water Plan. And your plan already includes conservation, drought, and climate trends as themes in the water plan. And you specifically mentioned legislation, corrective or remedial legislation, as a possible mechanism for moving forward. So it's in that vein that we did this analysis. And we think that there are a lot of options for strengthening water conservation, drought planning, and climate resiliency efforts in a legislative approach. And we'll talk to you about that in this presentation. Here is a screen capture from the water plan, which talks about the various categories and options. And we have arrows pointing to the areas that we are specifically looking at in this presentation. So water conservation incentives and rate structures is one. Statewide drought planning and mechanisms to enforce water restrictions, like watering restrictions, is another. Future Class B, water use accounting is another area. Leak detection and water loss control is certainly one area. And then changes to laws and regulations under a regulatory approach is what we'll be covering here in this presentation. So there are nine different areas that we're going to race through here in the presentation today. And we're going to talk to you a little bit about each one of them. And we're interested in your views, what you think about each of these areas and whether you think strengthening the existing laws and policies would make sense for the state of Connecticut. The factors, though, that need to be considered are not just how much water will it save and what's the impact on water use, but basically where you're starting from. You know, what's the baseline law you already have on the books? How feasible is this idea of getting legislative passage? What's the level of effort after the law passes, both in terms of implementation on the ground by various entities, whether they be state agencies or utilities, and how do they get enforced, and what's the enforcement burden that might be created there? Are there financial resources required, like staffing or funding? You know, that's a consideration. And there may be other criteria, other factors to consider that are not in this list that you'll let us know about that you think we ought to be scoring, responses on. But that's kind of the background to where we wanted to head in terms of having a discussion about all of those topic areas we just mentioned. So let's dive right in and talk about plumbing fixture standards. Federal law passed in 1992 sets minimum flow rates for commonly used plumbing fixtures. 1.6 gallons per flush for toilets, 2.5 gallons per minute for shower heads, 1 gallon flush for urinals. That was passed in 1992, went into effect January 1st, 1994. Connecticut actually already had that in place for toilets, certainly, in 1989. They Connecticut was one of 13 states in the country that passed legislation in 1989 with an early requirement for 1.6 gallon per flush toilet. So the link that's there in the presentation is a link to the current set of statutes and fixture standards in Connecticut, which now match the federal standards, which is the basis of the 1989 law, which has been revised several times since. And we think that, you know, this is a very simple solution to saving water statewide. You know, this has been done greater than federal law. Standards have been adopted by various states. We'll talk about those in a minute. But the point I want to make here is that this deals with where the fixtures are sold, at the point of sale, like big box stores and plumbing supply houses, as well as new construction, as well as installation in housing. So it is both point of sale and installation. So what are you thinking of reducing it to? Well, the EPA's WaterSense program already has a certification of fixtures that use less water, 20% less water than the federal standard. So toilets are now down to 1.28 gallons per flush, shower heads 2 gallons a minute, urinals 0.5 gallon per flush. And these have been performance tested. Every fixture that gets a WaterSense label is guaranteed to perform a whole lot better than we probably had guarantees on the 1.6. So we're seeing a number of states go to those WaterSense labeled fixtures because they are proven performers and proven water savers. You can't get the WaterSense label without being 20% more efficient than the federal law. And so what does that mean for Connecticut? Well, it means that there's, you know, great opportunity for change out of a lot of fixtures that are high flow fixtures. And this is an analysis that Bill's done to sort of identify what that potential retrofit area is. And we're not suggesting that you actually fund retrofits, but we're letting you know that there's enough older fixtures out there that with point of sale requirements in place and people doing bathroom remodels as they do, there's a great opportunity for a lot of those fixtures to be replaced with more water efficient fixtures. So there's
Marianne?
Yes.
Marianne, can I say something? This is Dave. Could you or Bill just very quickly explain how you were able to derive these estimates of opportunity from the census?
Absolutely. This is Bill. And so this was a fairly quick analysis, but we use these types of models quite frequently based on housing stock age. And so the state of Connecticut's housing stock was largely built prior to the Energy Policy Act taking effect. And so this looks simply at the number of homes built before 1994 and the average number of bathrooms per household. And then we apply a 4% replacement rate between then and now to determine that there's still, you know, I would call these fairly rough estimates, but you know, I used our model that we use quite frequently for this type of analysis. And you know, these are kind of ballpark figures. If anything, I rounded them down though. And then the CII estimates for toilets and urinals is based on population numbers, and that uses a model that looks at the frequency of facilities based on population, whereas the residential ones are based on housing stock values.
And for those who are not familiar, CII stands for commercial, industrial, and institutional. So that's where those fixtures are.
I would say too for the urinals. I know we're on fixed time, but there's even more urinals that are 1 gallon per flush in that ballpark. So if Connecticut moved to a 0.5 gallon per flush, there's probably another 30,000 that over time would then get changed down to that 0.5 gallon. So I'll stop talking there.
So as I mentioned a little earlier, there's considerable precedent for states to do this, you know, and it's not a position that is unusual for Connecticut. I mean, you played that role in 1989 when you passed the 1989 law, so you were a leader there. It's usually fairly straightforward to enact at the legislature. The savings are free to the utilities. And they occur in the background and can be measured in the background, but they definitely happen just automatically. So what we have seen is that there have been a number of states that have gone forward and done this. And the first states to do it really were the obvious ones, California, Texas. But Georgia was a leader. He was one of the first states to enact a similar law requiring water sense fixtures, followed by Colorado, Nevada, state of Washington. So in addition to California and Texas, they have adopted fixture consumption limits more strict than the federal standard, usually referencing water sense. Colorado prohibits the sale of fixtures, and making sure that that they don't achieve WaterSense certification, they can't be sold in the state of Colorado. Illinois, although it doesn't have a statewide law, it does require that all new Lake Michigan diversion permittees, they requires them to install WaterSense labeled fixtures in their service areas. So that's a requirement that's there. Vermont, Hawaii, Washington State, they all have standards, including in Washington's case, standards for spray sprinkler bodies, irrigation devices, tying them to the WaterSense specification. So there's lots of precedent for this. New York has built it into their building code, state of New York. So these kinds of requirements are not that out of the ballpark. And so that's one of the recommendation, the options that we would like you to consider. Tied to that is what we might do with state building and plumbing codes in Connecticut. Connecticut currently doesn't have a requirement for water efficient products in state building or plumbing codes. And so that's something that could be added, mandating efficient fixtures and standardizing the replacement of those fixtures over time with water sense level fixtures. So one option could be to codify fixture flow rates to be more stringent than the federal standards in new construction, and also in updates to existing construction and retrofits. So that would be something that could also be done through legislative requirement, stipulating that the building and plumbing codes must be modified. And so here are some examples of states that have done that. Georgia and New York have both updated their existing building and plumbing codes, as I mentioned, with water efficiency requirements, and Texas as well. California got points because they adopted a green building standards code called CalGreen that actually is even deeper than WaterSense standards. We're not necessarily recommending that here in Connecticut, but there's the ability to to develop a specialized green code that you might want to take a look at doing. Another topic area for discussion is the area of water loss and control of leakage. Repairing leaks in a distribution system, can lower utility costs for main breaks. If the leaks are repaired before the main has a disastrous failure, then you're saving the utility money in repairs. But also replacing meters that are under registering water consumption can provide enhanced revenue. And we do see that replacing source meters, replacing blocked bulk utility meters, when they are not registering correctly, that's your cash register at the utility. So that can provide enhanced revenue. And so we think that there's room to expand a better definition of water loss control in Connecticut laws that aligns more closely with the American Water Works Association methodology in the M36 manual. And we have seen several states that have model laws that we can use as a framework if Connecticut is interested in doing that. Georgia was the first one to do this and became a national leader in this area. But Wisconsin, the state of Washington, California, and Texas, they're all leaders in this area. California is even setting reduction targets, leakage reduction targets that will be customized on a utility basis. So they're really doing a lot of work in this area. Colorado has done some work. They're not a leader in this, but they do have a very robust technical assistance program called the Colorado Water Loss Initiative that offers free training. So there are ways that I think water loss can be expanded in Connecticut, and some of those options are to first and foremost start to move away from the term unaccounted for water that leads to a whole lot of mischief making in numbers when you can say, well, something isn't accounted for and there's no way to account for it. The methodology being used today in the water balances account for everything and determine with a degree of you know, documented validity, how accurate those estimates are in those accounted for categories. So one of the requirements is certainly to require reporting that would specify this kind of accounting according to a water balance and require them on an annual basis validated by water loss experts. There's free water loss audit software that AWWA distributes, and so you could require, as some states have done, that utilities report in that framework. You could require that there be water loss control programs within utility systems. You could require that leak detection and leak repair occur. Some states require leak detection. Some states go further, require leak repair of all leaks that are found in a specified time frame. But, you know, how far you want to go in this is purely up to you. You can identify a numeric limit on the amount of water loss that you feel ought to take place in public and private water systems. And as Colorado does, offer technical assistance to water systems that are conducting these water loss audits, because there is a learning curve that goes along with this. But there's a big movement in the water industry now to really make water loss accounting and water loss control a lot more specific and accountable. And that's why the term unaccounted for water needs to disappear in a lot of state references. Many states had a percent unaccounted for water, not to exceed a certain percent in state law, and gradually that percent unaccounted for water is being removed and being substituted with other water loss measures. Another area to look at would be water right permitting and requiring conservation measures in that. And Connecticut already has a pretty robust requirement for planning water conservation measures as a condition to receiving water diversion permits, water supply plans, approval of water supply plans, et cetera. And this applies both to public and private water suppliers. But, you know, like anything else, you could strengthen that a little. You could require water suppliers to incorporate the stakeholders in the process of conservation planning. You know, that helps with the implementability and making sure that the measures that are scripted in the conservation plan are ones that will have a great likelihood of getting done. Require that the conservation plans be incorporated into permits as an enforceable condition. We see that occurring in various places, but that's something to consider here. And tying permit approval to proven implementation of water conservation measures in a plan. That's a little trickier, but that's one of the options that could be considered there as well. Drought preparedness planning is a specific area unto its own, and I'd like to just turn it over to Bill to just walk us through the slides here.
All right. Thank you, Marianne. And yeah, you know, like permitting, Connecticut does already require water providers to include drought in their water supply plan. So it's a piece of that. But one thing we see some other states do is require standalone drought plans. There are about seven states throughout the U.S. that require water utilities to submit standalone drought plans. And along with that, one of the options would be to increase the frequency of those plans being updated and refreshed. And what we commonly see in states that do have standalone plans is a 5-year interval. So that's just an option. There's also been quite a bit of work done on drought. For example, the American Water Works Association just published its most updated M60 manual, which is drought preparedness and planning. So there may be some things from that publication that could be gleaned for a refresh or an update. So if this was an area the state was interested in updating laws, there are some resources out there that could be leaned on, as well as some other states that may have some things going on that could be looked at in terms of a precedent.
Excuse me, Bill, it's Steve Rupar.
Yeah.
Can you clarify, I'm unsure what you mean by standalone drought plan. How does that differ from the type of plans that water utilities in Connecticut are currently doing?
So yeah, my understanding, and we're talking about the state requirement. So that doesn't mean that a utility in Connecticut doesn't have their very own drought plan. It stands alone by itself. But that we see a lot of states require water utilities to submit a standalone drought plan to the state. And so right now in Connecticut, it's part of the water supply plan that has to be updated every 6 to 9 years. And so a standalone plan is not required. However, you know, within the water supply plan in Connecticut, water utilities do have to address drought. They have to look at 4 different stages, drought advisory, drought watch, drought warning, and then drought emergency. And those have 10, 15, 20, and 25% reduction targets, and actions do have to be included. You know, those are requirements. So it's not like there's nothing there. But in looking at these different topics for potential law and policy updates, you know, we're just noting that some of the things we do see out there is that a standalone drought plan is required in some states. And that's just to ensure that the utilities do have them. So that's not to say that no water utility in Connecticut has a standalone plan, just that it's not required by the state. Did that answer your question?
This is Denise. I just want, just following up on that, in the town of Greenwich, along with the water utility, we did have a separate drought plan that was put together with the several municipalities and the water utility at one point. It's kind of getting old and hasn't been updated in a while. So basically now they're really just looking at, the water supply plan, but the drought plan really did get into everybody's role, the municipal roles, and there was a real buy-in and everybody signed into it. And so I guess what I look, so I see that, I see the benefit of it because I've worked under that for the past 20 years when I was in Greenwich. That said, I was wondering if there were any, if you know of any benefits of having it as a separate document that in some of the things I may have, I just mentioned, is there a reason that they're doing this, or is it just to make sure that there was one?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, A, thank you for your commentary. That's very helpful and insightful. But I think, you know, having it as a standalone plan makes the drought plan its own entity. It's not something someone's going to go dig through their water supply plan, and it also makes sure it's not an afterthought. You know, it's a standalone plan. Another thing, you know, the new M60 manual from AWWA focuses on is making sure someone at the agency owns that plan and is in charge of leading the plan and has engaged with all the different departments within the water utility. So I think, you know, kind of what you alluded to, having a standalone plan, it kind of increases the strength of it and, you know, makes it easier to engage with different stakeholders and really helps have more of a solid plan and ownership in place, if you will.
Okay, so moving on, while we're in the topic of planning, we wanted to also mention the water conservation plan requirements. And we think there are some ideas that Connecticut might consider with some statutory updates. One of them would be to require the state to draft guidelines to aid water suppliers in preparing their water conservation plans. Some states have done that. Colorado is one example of that. Requiring water suppliers to incorporate stakeholder plan development is another option. Increase the frequency of required plan updates is another option. Require the implementation of plans or other water conservation measures. And implementation is something that many states don't require. You know, they require the planning, but then there's no tie into the actual implementation of those requirements. So, you know, and again, Connecticut has had that history of having required that in the past. The 1989 statute that required that utilities over 10,000 population served implement water conservation programs, that was an implementation requirement. So that's, but that law didn't continue. That was a one-time programmatic effort. So this is something you might want to consider going forward, allowing the state to penalize, fine, or revoke permits or withhold privileges from a water supplier for not implementing plans. That sounds very draconian, but, you know, it's something, again, an option to consider. So these are areas of where there might be some opportunities to strengthen the water conservation plan requirements that you already have.
Marianne, David here. No, I just want to, go back. I just want to clarify a few things. There are old guidelines out. They're certainly outdated, but there is a conservation plan guideline that the state did prepare. Would need to be dusted off and updated. But as far as the implementation for diversion permits, it's typically a requirement of the permit that you report annually on the measures you've undertaken that are consistent with your approved water conservation plan. And so that is a, as I say, typically an annual requirement. DEEP, in my experience, doesn't often weigh in on were you, aggressive enough, were you successful in implementing, but it is at minimum a requirement, as I say, typically for diversion permit holders.
Good. So you have that already.
To a limited degree.
Yeah. So we'll talk about this in a minute with regard to metering, but one of the issues that we discovered in doing the state scorecard is there's a difference between it already occurring and whether or not you require it in state law. So you may have done draft guidelines to aid water suppliers and water conservation plans, but it didn't appear in a policy or a directive in statute. So that's something you might just want to codify, and so it's not always at the whim of whatever administration is there. It's actually a part of the legal way of doing business. So that leads to the whole financial assistance issue, which I know is always troublesome for most states because no state's rolling in money these days. So this is maybe a topic that is not of relevance here in Connecticut, but we wanted to just outline it because it was one area that we did some work in. There are states that spend a fair amount of money in promoting water conservation with its utilities, and Colorado has a water efficiency grant program that administers with utilities. It's not a large one. It's only $550,000, but it's still money. Texas is big money, but you'd imagine that for Texas, given the size of the state and the water crises it goes through, but it runs a state water implementation fund to financially support projects that its state water plan is proposing, and 20% of that money must be devoted to conservation and recycling, water reuse. So if you do the math on it, they plan to allocate $27 billion by 2050, but they've already allocated $2 billion right now. And if 20% of $2 billion is required for conservation and reuse, that's $400 million. So that's big money. We certainly don't expect that kind of investment in Connecticut, but financial assistance of some kind, particularly for the smaller systems, might be a consideration. I mean, smaller systems are struggling, especially with these conservation measures. So that might be something to consider. Yes.
Are you aware of any states that do it sort of on a revolving fund basis so that once they have a pot of money, it keeps being replenished?
So under the state revolving loan fund guidelines, that can be done in states. The EPA allows the funding of water efficiency programs that way. Most states do not use the money for that purpose, but it is allowed. Whether individual states have set up revolving funds is a separate question. I know California attempted to set up a revolving fund for commercial and industrial programs, and that did not pass. It has to be seeded, of course, to start with. And that could be one very excellent way to get this going, to provide seed money for a revolving loan fund, which then gets paid back. What we see is that utilities tend to prefer grants over loans, so the uptake will be less. But you might see in the commercial and industrial sector where having the availability for industrial and commercial retrofits and funding for those retrofits available on an upfront basis that they could pay back out of the savings that they achieve going forward, that could have some traction. That might be an idea to consider. Alongside technical assistance or funding assistance is technical assistance, and you do offer some technical assistance already, but like anything, there's an opportunity for expansion, and this could help create better uniformity among conservation programs already underway in the state, but especially will help smaller systems that, again, don't have the resources that the larger systems do, and will probably welcome some directed assistance. And so several states do offer online and direct technical assistance to water utilities to help them with planning and implementation. We also at the Alliance for Water Efficiency offer help as well, but this technical assistance function is something that's also provided for in statute or regulation. And then the last area we wanted to talk about was the whole area of metering, billing, and conservation rate structures. And you know, as we all know, water saving can be generated when you actually measure what water is being used, and where you have metering and volumetric billing. You know, we tend to give points in our scorecard for those states that require that by state law. A state like Connecticut that's 100% metered anyway, it doesn't seem like it would make sense to have a state law to do that. But you might consider that in these days of now, you know, developments that are that might go in, you know, standalone houses where a homeowner association still will have master meters. You don't want to ever encourage a situation where an individual residence or dwelling is not metered. Might be something to just clean up in state law and get the points for that. But requiring rate structures that encourage water conservation, that's an important issue. I know it's something that you're interested in, judging by the discussions that I've heard already in your committee. We know that generates additional savings, and we've got some state examples there to show you. So in metering, Washington State has a statutory requirement. All new direct service connections must be metered upon activation of service. Georgia requires even sub-metering of new multi-unit residential buildings, retail and light industrial buildings. So sub-metering is a refinement on that. But requiring volumetric billing is something Wisconsin has gone forward to require. All water sold by utility shall be on the basis of meter measurement and volumetric billing. So that's one thing to point out. And then your neighbor Rhode Island has a conservation rate structure policy that says rate structures must be adequate to pay all costs associated with water supply, must be equitable, sensitive to economic impacts, and encourage the efficient use of water. State of Minnesota requires a conservation pricing and a rate structure if utilities not doing any other kind of conservation program. So that's an interesting approach as well. So the last area to talk about is climate change resiliency, and I'll just ask Bill to do these next two slides, and then I think we're done.
Yeah, thank you, Mary Ann. I just have two quick slides here. When we were looking through the state water plan, we noticed item number 6 there, prepare for uncertain future climate. And this is something we've worked in a bit in terms of state planning and policy. And what's really important here from our perspective and the focus we're taking here is what is the impact going to be on water utilities? Climate change is such a broad topic from preparing, you know, mitigating, and it affects all these different sectors and areas. So it can get kind of tricky and convoluted. But one of the things we've seen in practice that really helps water utilities and states when it comes to water is conducting vulnerability assessments. So understanding what vulnerabilities your water providers may face with a changing climate. So the options we have over there on the right are conducting a statewide vulnerability assessment, and this is with a focus on water providers, and then also requiring water providers to conduct a vulnerability assessment related to climate change. And, you know, maybe that requirement won't work, and you could provide training and technical assistance in that area if that wasn't something that was feasible. And Marianne, if you could go to the next slide. Why vulnerability assessments? Well, it's just a foundational piece of preparing and becoming more resilient to climate change. And like I said, we find this topic to be just very convoluted, and people throw around terms a lot without really focusing on the vulnerabilities that a water utility may face. So it will help water utilities understand their exposure and risk related to climate change. And it's important because all situations are unique. You know, at the Alliance for Water Efficiency, we do a lot of technical assistance. And one of our favorite answers is it depends, because every situation is unique. And that's why a vulnerability assessment can be incredibly powerful. Just an example here of something that may result from a changing climate is you may have more frequent heavy rainfall events. That's a pretty common theme we see. And that can increase turbidity of water supplies. It mostly impacts surface water. So again, different exposure to that effect of climate change based on your supply type. And then beyond that, some utilities, if, you know, let's say there's five utilities that are going to be exposed to this, they have surface water, they're going to have increased turbidity. Some utilities may already be equipped to handle that. You know, they may have a filtration process that can handle that no problem, whereas other utilities may have to retool their system or even look at alternative supplies to switch to during those events. And those are just examples, but it's something in our research around climate change resiliency that's really stuck out to us, is that starting out with those vulnerability assessments are critical, and the state can play a role in encouraging that, providing assistance and training on that, or even requiring utilities to do those assessments so they're prepared and know what steps they need to take to be more resilient. So with that, okay. I believe we're wrapped up.
So to finish up here, what we'd like to do, we've thrown a bunch of ideas at you. What we'd like to find out from you is what you think of those ideas. And so what we'd like to do is we'll write up a little summary report with a little bit more detail than what's in this presentation. And what we'd like to do is send out a survey to you, either just to this committee, or if you think it should be to a broader group like the Water Planning Council Advisory Group as well, or anything broader than that. But what we'd like to do is ask you some questions on these factors to consider, what you think in terms of each of these ideas, because what we don't want to do is do any further work on these topics unless we know you're interested in moving forward with them. So I was thinking, Dave and Virginia, that this might be a way to engage the committee in helping choose what we winnow this down to going forward. Because I'm assuming that everything we've said today is not an automatic yes. There are going to be lots of opinions that you have that you need to forward to us. So what we'd like to do is just follow up with you then with a little survey about it. Does that sound like a good plan?
Yes, that sounds like a very good plan. Thank you, Marianne.
Okay.
And it's something that when do you expect that we might see that survey?
I think in a couple of weeks. I think we could probably put something together in a couple of weeks. Okay. The report itself is not going to be overly detailed. It'll be mostly what's in this presentation. But what we want to construct is a little bit of a matrix that we can send out with the survey and then ask. We'll probably do it in SurveyMonkey, something like that. Well, we just need to figure out the logistics of that.
Okay, so I would ask folks, when we get that survey from Marianne, that you take a look at it, do it, and be thinking about it so that at our next meeting a month from now, we can have a good discussion on how we might see proceeding. I also would say that I think we need to interact with the Water Planning Council and really map out how much responsibility they want us to take. Obviously, the final ideas that get pitched to what I hope is next year's legislative session would come from the Water Planning Council. They have given us the lead on this issue in working with the Alliance for Water Efficiency, but I think I would like to have some very explicit guidelines from them in terms of we say we should do A, B, C, and F, and then they just are the pushers at that point. So.
Okay. Yeah, and I'm happy to also, you know, before the survey gets finalized, show it to a broader group, maybe the Water Planning Council itself, to make sure they're comfortable with what we're doing here I mean, Joe, whatever you all think is the appropriate way to go.
Okay. Marianne, this is David. Thank you. And Bill, thank you. You know, there's some good opportunities there. I think the fixture and appliance standards certainly, you know, keeps recurring as something that, you know, as you pointed out, we were leading the pack at one point, and now we've sort of fallen behind. I will say that Connecticut did have a bad experience with that when it first came out, especially with the 1.6 gallon per flush toilets, because the standard came out ahead of the technology. And so there was almost a black market for older toilets at the time when you were doing renovations. Hopefully that's far enough in the past where there would be an appetite to consider legislatively whether or not we could go to a water sense standard. But the big factor, as you well know, in any of these initiatives, well, these initiatives would be the revenue impact also.
Right.
So again, it sort of points to the importance of, if we're going to get people on board to support something legislatively, that we really do a good job addressing that revenue impact, because utilities by and large have historically, maybe the last 10, 15 years, a couple percent per year loss in residential water use,
right,
consumption, that we all believe is attributable to,
right,
or just these sort of newer, more efficient models of things,
yeah,
that are out there.
For many systems, and it is 1% per year, just from the cost.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And that's, you know, that has a deleterious effect on the revenue. So we need to get that right. What I would like, if you can send it out after the fact, are the Georgia, Washington, Wisconsin, and Texas, whichever you think would be a good or a couple good examples for us on the water loss laws, the actual laws that they have, so that we could, as a group, take a look at the actual language, how they've codified that. And then lastly, have you come across any relevant legislation that is related specifically to outdoor irrigation use and how other states may attempt that?
You mean in terms of outdoor watering restrictions?
Connecticut,
yes,
has requirements for irrigation sensors, for rain sensors to be,
right,
installed.
Right,
no,
you were one of the first states to do that, yeah. We do see some controller standards happening in states like California. We did see in Georgia that they set a requirement that they would set watering restrictions based on a statewide mandate, and they prohibited municipalities from setting anything stricter. That was very controversial at the time that was passed. So there's a lot of up and down movement in the area of outdoor water use regulation. But that is one of the areas that you have identified for us to do some specific work on and advise you on. So that's a topic, I think, even separate from this one, where we are planning to come in to you with a presentation on what we're seeing are the best ways to handle the need for outdoor watering restrictions.
Thank you.
Marianne, I wanted to thank you for including a stakeholder process in some of these items, particularly with drought plans. While the public does have an opportunity to participate in water management through the state's diversion permitting process, with our grandfather diversions, there's often not an opportunity to speak up for how water is managed,
yeah,
with grandfather diversions. So I think it would provide a lot of confidence from both customers and stakeholders, both in the receiving and the donor basins, to be able to participate in the process of approving, or at least being able to comment on a drought plan or an emergency supply plan.
Yeah.
Marianne, the last topic you talked about in detail on the plan was climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes,
I wanted to just touch base on that because, and I put a little bit in the notes, but you know, the governor put in a new last August, the Governor's Council on Climate Change, the GC3, and they are moving forward to have out for the next legislative session. We won't be done with this report by then, excuse me, but certainly I think we need to be paying attention how we marry that. And particularly, you mentioned the vulnerability of water supplies, and a lot of people look at it from the planning and adaptation perspective, the resiliency perspective. But I think we do need to look at, and I again put in my notes, that there's a nexus between water conservation and energy savings as well, mm-hmm, particularly mm-hmm. when you're sewage treatment plants, but also water treatment plants, especially right. you know, in terms of the water they use, pumping water from one place to another. Right. So I think the idea that we really need to pay attention to that. So I just wanted to bring that up, that that is happening. We can, there's several of us. I know Alicia and myself, and there's several others who are in working groups looking at this. I happen to be kind of gotten involved with a work group that's a crossover between the, what I would say would be the non-energy savings. So that's what they're looking at. So they're looking at things like forest, you know, carbon sequestration in forests, those types of things, but also this crossover of energy savings, not just from alternative energy. So yeah. I really think we need to pay attention to that and keep you in the loop. So I think going forward, if you need more information on that, and there's a whole website on it, be looking at what those various groups are doing.
Okay, yeah, that would be very helpful. And I know there's an effort underway at DEEP and other agencies to comply with the governor's executive order on the greening of water use and energy use. And so that intersects as well, and I would welcome an opportunity to coordinate with everybody there so that we're all kind of singing from the same song sheet.
Thank you.
Hey, Mary Ann, it's Steve Rupar again.
Hey, Steve.
Just a somewhat related comment and a counter point of view, at least a bit, and interested if you have any input on this. You know, as you decrease water demands, as conservation becomes more successful, it can be too much of a good thing. The infrastructure that's out there for water utilities is sized in many cases for larger demands. And from a water quality perspective, your storage tanks are too big. So there's costs associated with retrofitting, some of this very large infrastructure. Water quality in large mains designed to go to some factory that's now using no water is a problem. Those mains may need to be replaced. And then even from the energy perspective, if you are decreasing demands to a large extent, people should be aware that pumps were designed for certain demand conditions and certain head conditions. And if those change, those pumps may now be operating very inefficiently. I don't know if you've done any research in that, but I think that's something we shouldn't lose sight of, that there are, it's not just a win-win for everybody. There's potentially associated operational and capital costs with reduced water use.
So, Steve, you're bringing up an issue that we talk about a lot at the Alliance for Water Efficiency, the intersection of public health and the declining chlorine residual that is happening because the pipes are oversized and the water is moving more slowly through the system. And we're seeing this happen whether there's conservation programs or not. We're seeing this happen in systems that are not experiencing rapid growth, or they're maybe even declining in population. And so there is an infrastructure problem out there, a water quality infrastructure issue. And we've had several webinars on this topic. We participate in AWWA's Premise Plumbing Committee. We're really, really interested in this topic, which is one of the reasons why we would never recommend going lower than WaterSense, because we know that WaterSense has been performance tested and we have experience with it in a building envelope. To go too much lower than that risks bringing in a lot of public health issues, you know, within buildings themselves. And we know utilities are going to have to do a lot of flushing. We're seeing utilities now trying to capture the flush water and reuse it in some other meaningful way. So we're sensitive to the infrastructure issues that you mentioned. But I do have to say that I think it's happening whether conservation occurs or not. Our demand is just declining across the country. And so this is a problem that has to be taken into consideration. And I agree with you.
Okay, are there any other questions for Mary Ann or Bill or Lacey? Well, thank you all. That was very interesting, and both in terms of helping us narrow down what kinds of recommendations we might be making, but just the reminding me of some of the stuff that's already in state law or is not. Yeah. So thank you so much.
Yep.
In the interest of time, I'm going to change the order of things on our agenda a bit. Mike, your summary presumably will be very quick. Mike Dietz, domestic groundwater wells.
You want me to go now, Virginia?
Yes, please.
Sure. So two things. So I did send the final version of the white paper that we had produced. I was not at that last meeting, but I got the notes from Corinne, and the suggestion was that we should submit this to the Water Planning Council anyway, even though the Department of Public Health has developed this database or is in the process of getting this database out there. So Corinne and I completed our stuff on this. Well,
excuse me, just a second. A correction, it's the Department of Consumer Protection.
Yes, Mike, you just said Department of Public Health, but it's Consumer Protection.
Mike seems to be frozen.
He just went into shock.
Yeah, well, while we wait for Mike to get unfrozen, Steve, do you have a short summary, or is it something that could be shared via email?
Very short summary.
Okay.
We've ramped up the frequency of our meetings a little bit. We've met twice since our last implementation work group, May 21st and June 12th. We had meetings. We've gone through the August and October in 2016 interagency drought meeting minutes, and just continue to discover some interesting things. Most recently, had some good discussion about the role of the governor's office, and starting to think about some regulatory statutory changes related to that. Also, we have two new members, surprisingly. Iris Kaminsky and Peter Gallant have both joined our group, so thanks to them. Next meeting is either June 25th or 26th. There's a doodle poll out, and that's it.
Okay, thanks so much. And for those people who aren't regular on this call, Steve has been heading up a group looking at the way the 2016-2017 drought in Fairfield County was handled and how much it followed the guidance of the old drought plan and what it would be if they had been using the new drought plan. So that's the basis of the work that they've been doing. Okay, thanks very much for that. And while I mentioned that, saying people who aren't typically on this call, if you're new to these calls or if your name and affiliation is not obvious and we might not know who you are, if you could just send Dan, would you be the recipient of it, just a description of who you are, who your name is, and who you are. That's daniel.aubin@ct.gov. so that would help us get the roster of people who have been on this call. Okay, so I'm going to, as you see, the slate was on our agenda. We have
Virginia?
The work. Yes, Mike.
I'm back.
Oh, you're back. You're unfrozen.
Yeah. Sorry, I don't know what happened there. So you want me to just finish up quickly? Or?
Yes, please.
Okay, so I'm not sure where you lost me or where I lost you, but I was just talking about the white paper. So we've kind of done everything we can. We've gotten folks' comments, and I think it says everything we wanted to say. You know, it's not 100 pages long and overly detailed, which I think is a good thing. We kind of did that on purpose. So we'll need to discuss what the process is from here on out, how we submit that to the Water Planning Council.
Well, basically, this is the group. The implementation work group will be the ones that submit it to the Water Planning Council. As part of our setup, we will make sure that the advisory group has a chance to look at that, because they are advisory to us as well as to the Water Planning Council.
Okay.
So when you sent it out, did you share it with the advisory group or just the implementation group?
It was just the implementation group and our other, you know, sub work group that we had.
Okay. So folks on the implementation work group, if you have any thoughts on the white paper that the domestic groundwater well group prepared, please get them to me and Dave, and we'll see if there are any changes that we would want to do, suggest that the subgroup do. If not, then we will pass it along to the advisory group for their input.
And now that you say that, Virginia, I don't know that I sent it to everybody on our implementation work group. I sent it to you and Dave and obviously Corinne, but
well, then if you would please send it, or I can send it out to our group. Either way will work.
I'll send you the final copy right after I get off the call.
Okay, great. And then I'll send it to this group, and then we'll follow through that process.
Yes. The only other thing that's happening is Corinne has convened a small group to work with Jay Cohen at DCP to get feedback on how their database will be set up. So some of the same people that are on our sub-work group, Meredith Metcalf, Gary Robbins, and others from DPH, were on a call yesterday, and it sounds like that's progressing nicely. Corinne, I don't know if there's anything you want to add on that.
No, well, we need to give them additional feedback, but we'll be working on that over the next month or so.
Okay, great. And the only other thing is the water quality piece that we talked about at the very beginning of this. It sounds like I did send out a request to our existing group to see who wanted to continue to participate and try to tackle that water quality testing question. So, how we can get more testing of our private wells in the state. So I had a handful of people say that they would be interested in continuing on to work with that. So I'll talk to us, the smaller group on our implementation work group to figure out how to proceed with that.
One of the things related to that, Mike, would be in many ways it really is a new topical subgroup that would be reaching out for new people to participate in it. And
yep.
So if you would fill out that proposal format to propose a new work group, I believe I forwarded that to you. If not, I can do that again.
Yep. Yep.
And then we can share that with this group and then go about soliciting interest.
Okay.
From folks who have not already been involved in that, because there certainly are people from Water Quality Labs or from the real estate industry, or there are other flavors of folks that might want to participate in that discussion.
Yep.
So that
gotcha.
we would treat it as if it were a new group, but I really appreciate the fact that you and some of the members of the committee are willing to stay on and continue in that discussion. Speaking
Virginia,
of those, yes, Corinne, go ahead.
I'm sorry, on the agenda, I noticed that it has a comment that perhaps we should include septic systems in that work group. And I'm not sure that's a good idea at all, but maybe that would, I don't know if that's where you were headed next in your discussion, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. That is something that to consider, and
I'm not sure where that came from either. I look at that as a very separate issue, and I don't think it should be part of this group, but Virginia, I'm willing to entertain your pitch if you have one.
No, this is Dave. Mike, I would agree that it does seem to be really unique enough that it could be a separate topic. I think it was a question that just came from the outset. One of our members or somebody just was questioning whether or not this was going to be included in. But as I say, I would suggest you focus solely on domestic well water quality at this point. That's a big enough issue in itself.
Yeah, I agree.
And I would be really cautious about including things that weren't already addressed in the state water plan and discussed prior to the approval of the state water plan.
Is there, I don't recall where that suggestion originally came from. Is there anybody on this call who would like to explain why they think it is important? Maybe the idea came from somebody?
Sure. This is Bruce Wickson from OPM, and it might have been me who suggested it. And my primary reason for suggesting it is that the people who are really opposed to say, inspection requirements for wells or what have you are going to be from the real estate and development industry. And they're also opposed to doing the same with septic systems. So my suggestion was not based on the, I don't know what to call it, the technology or the environmental issues being raised as much as it would allow them to participate one time rather than divide it into two different things because they are very related, and but more from a political side than from, like I said, a technological or environmental side. That was the only reason I suggested it.
Other people's thoughts?
I see your logic on it now, Bruce, but I think I'll stand behind my original feeling that it should not be included at this point.
This is Denise. I agree. I think it should be separate. Obviously, there are some septic issues that come up when you're talking about water quality in wells, separating distances, soils, you know, the fact that that you're recharging your groundwater with, you know, through your septic system. So there are issues that come up, but there's a whole other range of things that happen with septic systems. So I would keep that separate, except for when the discussion overlaps and impacts wells directly.
Bruce, were you going to say something?
No.
Okay. You just lit up. It sounds then from the comments that I've heard that at least at this point we would not include the septic systems as part of this topical subgroup. So unless anybody objects to that vehemently, that's the direction that we'll take. Good. One of the things, the slate was on the agenda. I don't want to spend too much time on that because we don't have much. As you may recall, we have a vacancy for somebody in the out of stream category. We are hoping to have that be somebody who's had a focus on agriculture. And last time we had talked about the possibility of Janice, forgive me, is it Elmire? And she's sitting in on this call to get a sense of us so that she can decide whether she might be interested in being considered to fill that position. So, but I don't want to spend any more time talking about that. We do also need to elect officers. Officially, I'm supposed to be out in the way it was originally written up. And obviously we've missed that deadline. But several things have changed in that we've gone from a chair and a vice chair to co-chairs. And so I want, before the next meeting, I'd like you all thinking about how we are going to propose handling chairs of this committee as we move forward, because we would need to change our guidelines as well as then decide who we wanted in those positions. So I'm going to put that out there as something to think about as homework. That being said, let's move on. And we had talked about... Yes.
Virginia David, the other thing I think we're just waiting on, Water Planning Council canceled its last meeting. I see Jack has joined us. Hello, Jack. But we just need affirmation of the members, because I think you had sent to them the results of our last discussion that everyone was willing to continue on.
Correct.
We just need them to sign off on that. And then I think we're in position to go through the election of officers, et cetera.
And we'll discuss that. That'll be on the agenda next meeting. The other thing, Virginia, do you want us to bring up what you're talking about in terms of term limits for co-chair? I mean, frankly, I don't have a term limit. I've been a Water Planning Council chair forever, as we all know, and I think I had a little hiatus when Dave Levasseur took over for a while. But I mean, I think continuity is very important as we go through this. Implementation of this plan. So, I mean, if the membership of the group is happy with the leadership, I think just me weighing in on this personally, I don't see a reason for a change. Plus, you know, I think you're doing a great job. So, the whole group and the leadership of the group. So, that's just my two cents. But people can think about it.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for that, Jack. And yes, people do think about it. As I said, I'm just trying to follow the original structure that was approved by the Water Planning Council. And if we don't stick with that, I think we should modify it just for, I don't know, not efficiency, but officialdom, and but something to think about before the next meeting rather than to spend any more time on it today. So last meeting we were talking, there was interest in having two new topical subgroups. As you may recall, we started with two that we thought we could really get our hands around as a prototype for this, how this system worked. We're just now with the groundwater group getting to the system point of it, in that the topical subgroup is going to be submitting their report to us. We're going to get input from the advisory group before we pass it along to the Water Planning Council. So we really haven't tested the entire process. My feeling at this point is that it's been working reasonably well, and I certainly would entertain people's their ideas. But there were two possible additional work groups proposed. One of the things that we need to talk about is that, do we have the capacity to handle two groups? We have the groundwater group morphing into a groundwater water quality group, so that's that isn't as if it's finished. And the drought group is not finished yet, is not finished their work yet. And so it's not as if we're going to replace two with two new ones. So we really need to determine if we have the capacity. Historically, we've sort of had the same faces, literally on Zoom, on the various water-related committees that we've had for the past decade or more. I was very pleased to see that some new faces were participating in these topical groups, which was exactly how they were designed. But I first want to have a brief discussion on whether we have the capacity to start two new groups or even one group. So input on that, please.
Yeah, Virginia, this is David. I think we do. We did talk about it at our last meeting when we envisioned at least starting to flesh out some of these proposals. And really, it's to your point that we've got a lot of, been able to get the word out now, or get broader participation by subject matter experts, I'll call them. So I think if we stick with our formula, which is to ensure that we have at least one, you know, one of our implementation work group folks sort of running and chairing these, I think we'll find we'll have enough bandwidth. And the other thing is our ability to take on more really depends upon the topic too. Is it going to be something that is really, you know, more involved and it's going to drag out a lot longer? You know, that could dictate whether or not we want to take on, you know, a few more things versus something that could be, while important, could be easier for a group to, you know, delve into and wrap up some recommendations in a more timely fashion.
Okay. Other thoughts? I know that there were some people who expressed a hesitation to move in new directions.
The other thing, Virginia and everyone, you know, that we talked about before is, and I think Jack's even raised it, we'll all be, our great-grandchildren will be working on implementation of the state water plan if we don't sort of step up our game at this point.
Yes, which brings me to another comment that I don't want to dwell on, but there has, coming out of a discussion that I had in a completely different forum in the last week, one of the things that we might want to consider soon is not exactly targeting one of the really thorny issues. And for instance, what I think of as a really thorny issue is the whole registered diversions, but to form a subgroup that would, their intent would be to come up with a plan of how to tackle the really thorny issues. My sense is that for 20 years now, almost 20 years, because something like registered diversions is such a hot topic, we keep saying, oh, we can't deal with it, and putting it off. And yes, we have gotten the database of what's actually out there, which I think is a crucial first step. But we might want to consider, as I said, a group that considers a plan of tackling that or some of the other really thorny issues. So just putting that out there for you to think about for discussion at another time.
I think, but just I'd like to, I was under the impression that the implementation work group would be taking the consensus-based recommendations and implementing them from the state water plan. There were many issues that were not tackled during the state water plan that need to be tackled in the second iteration to bring those forward to something that is consensus-based. It seems to me that the implementation work group would be, there are so many recommendations to implement that focusing on that, where this group would be better served by that, and leaving the non-consensus issues to the advisory group might be a better way to go.
I appreciate that input, Elisa. Thank you. Anyway, going back to the two proposals that we had, Dave, do you want to say something?
Well, we've got Dan Aubin is on still.
I'm here.
Dan, could you briefly just sort of run through the proposal that your group put together?
Sure, just give me one second. Oh, okay. Someone's sharing my notes. I don't think I'm sharing my notes. it messed up my screen. We met, we had a brief discussion. Thank you to Denise and Gail and Allie for spending some time to discuss potential marketing. And I'll try and keep my comments really short because I know we're running out of time. In general, it was a very, very good meeting. Nobody shared or had anything that really disagreed or went against anything each of us contributed. So we, right off the bat from the beginning, though, we did kind of identify that marketing and outreach is a kind of a separate focus than implementation and tracking. So going back to, I think as Virginia said just a couple of seconds ago, the capacity and making a future sub work group, you know, I go back to the conversation we had last June in 2019, which was as we met as a group, it was if a third or fourth work group to or sub work group were to exist, it needs to be based on like necessity, something that's extremely like important to carry on that extra workload. So, you know, maybe if tracking and implementation, if that's more important than marketing and outreach, maybe that's the direction the implementation work group should go in. But again, those were just comments that came out. In general, though, we did as a group think that those two items should be separated, mainly because when formulating a work group, there might be just a different skill set for individuals and for group members that might be sought out for that. And then in general, to be really concise, we really agreed that marketing and effective outreach is to educate those who are not familiar with the state water plan, and also to support those who are doing things related to the state water plan, but maybe don't have the marketing or branding tools to advertise that. And basically coming up with consistent messaging for individuals to utilize in their own capacity. And basically, once these pieces start to form, and if there was a sub work group, it's very possible that this sub work group could start to focus on short-term and long-term objectives. And the long-term objective would be to be finding funding, using the branding skills, the branding tools that we come up, that a committee could come up with to accelerate progress, to get more involvement from the public, or to get more involvement from anyone who wants to participate. Anyway, a lot of good discussion around many different items. Denise had a very, excellent point about, relating things that the governor's office is doing, certain initiatives such as climate change and the current work being done in energy and greenhouse gas emissions, and relating that back to marketing, but really back to the state water plan. And so those are a couple high level of things that were discussed. There was a brief discussion about, what the implementation work group might think about if it was acceptable, if maybe more than one person from a state agency was on a work group. That kind of came up in different ways, but that is, there's no particular side to it, to put it honestly. I could understand there being criticism or concern. And it was just something that was brought up, and I can elaborate more if someone really wants to know what that means. But basically the short version being that there might be individuals at any agency who might have better insight than just one person who represents, maybe a placeholder seat. So it was something I put in the notes and something I shared with Virginia. And, you know, I think it's worth a discussion, but either way, I respect what the group members feel.
Virginia, if I could just elaborate on that last topic. The group basically focused on the marketing and outreach piece. We thought that they should be divided, but we focused on the marketing and outreach. And that last piece of the discussion, and I appreciate folks who are state employees being sensitive to too many of them maybe being on a committee, but certainly one of the things we were looking at is that you may have someone in a state agency that's in a whole different department. And one of the ways this came up is, as you know, DEEP has an outreach and education department. So there were several of us who were saying, how do we utilize that department in our marketing and outreach? We don't have to reinvent the wheel if we have people who really know how to do this anyway. So we were thinking of bringing in some folks like that, but obviously you still might want someone from DEEP who's, you know, involved in you know, water, in the state water plan. So my recommendation, and again, I'm respectful of the discussion, but I am very comfortable with having more than one person from a state agency, sitting on the outreach and marketing and seeing how we get this done. I think it's really about identifying people who have those kind of skills to make this committee move forward, because...
Well, absolutely, Denise, on that last piece. We're designed to be tapping all the brains that have valuable input to any of these topics. I think, I'm just speaking personally, I think the odds of a conversation being dominated and hijacked by a particular agency are very, very low. If that were to happen, our original structure acknowledges that there might be some conflict resolution element to it. So as I said, in the very unlikely case that were to happen, we do have mechanisms to deal with it. So I certainly appreciate your concern about having multiple representatives from one particular state agency, but if they have something to offer.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I was saying. But, I understand why people wanted to bring this up, but I'm just saying my input is that the more the merrier. Let's get the work done.
Are there points of view that want to be discussed at this point?
Yes, I also just wanted to bring up, I was in that meeting and I agreed with everyone. I do think that the state agencies do have multiple people with expertise in different areas. And in addition to DEEP, PURA also has staff that is familiar with the marketing piece. We had a whole structure set up. We still do have people available. And we also have very capable legislative and press people that can help in this effort.
And I think that's probably true with all the state agencies to one
right.
And so
correct.
Are there people who would like to propose the opposite point of view and feel strongly that we should be very concerned about? We should really take this into consideration. Hearing none, I'd say let's not worry about it. So I see now that we have the actual proposal for this topical subgroup screen shared. And I apologize for sending it out fairly late, but hopefully you've had a chance to see this. It was in the email that went out this morning. So we can just scan it briefly and see if there are any questions.
So since there does not appear to be any discussion about the items on the plan, I would make a motion to approve this proposal to be able to send up so that we can send it up to the Water Planning Council for their approval.
Second. I'll second.
Not that I want to prejudge my colleagues, but I mean, I think this is a great idea. I mean, I've long been an advocate for more public relations in terms of the state water plan to get people out and about to chambers and CCMs and rotaries and what, you know, on base. I would love to get, I did actually ask Dennis House one day about getting onto face to state to just pre-pandemic to talk about the state water plan, because he thought it was a good idea. So, I mean, I think this is the type of thing that we really have to work long and get out more to the public in terms of what we're doing, because I bet you if it took a poll right now, there's not a lot of people out there that know the time and effort that went into this.
This is Lou. Is Lou. As I'm reading through this, this all looks good and seems to me to be, you know, some common sense action items that we need to incorporate. I guess the only question that I have is, what is really the end goal of this? In terms of, you know, as we do this public outreach to better inform people about what's happening, what is, I don't see anything on here indicating, you know, what is, what are some deliverables that we hope to get out of this, whether that be, you know, including some type of opportunity for public engagement, you know, public comment, a survey or something along those lines. I just think that's something that we need to think about as well.
Somebody from the committee want to respond to that?
Yeah, sure. And that's a good point. Part of the discussion that we had was that, you know, pending the insight from this group, and if the Water Planning Council, you know, approves to have the subwork group, would that the group itself would come up with certain deliverables? But when we talk about the short term, like in the scope area right now, the short term and long term, you know, really it's about educating those who are not familiar with the plan, involving those who, or better involving those who are already working on items from the plan. It's also creating a branding or toolbox. And what I mean by that, and what we discussed, was that giving individuals a phrase or a term or something, so that when an organization or a person or whatever, if someone's working on something that's related to the state water plan, that they actually can say, oh, this is a state water plan initiative. And one of the other deliverables and really big things too was that this was meant to engage, you know, the people, public, organizations in a different way to get better involvement and show venues and how people can participate in all these different committees. So that's definitely a focus too. The long-term focus for the work group, I think, would be building towards a branding and marketing goal and also gaining funding.
And to Lou's point, I know he was asking because, and you know, like, okay, well, how do you do that? And I think that's where the tools, whether it be survey or whatever, when you're going to put out a brand, you need to do all that work. So we didn't get into all the work that needed to be done. We just basically said, these are some of the, where we want to go with it. So.
Yeah, I think this looks good. And I'd love to participate if there's still room at the table.
Okay. So what I would like to, we've had a motion to move forward with this particular topical group, because voting is hard in this format. If there's anybody who does not support that or would want to abstain on such a vote, please let us know. Not hearing or seeing anybody, let's just declare this was approved unanimously. And on the agenda, you see that I had wanted to brainstorm participants and establish a chair. I'm not sure we have the time because we have one other proposal to look at. But is there somebody who's a member of the IWG who would be willing to chair this subgroup?
Is there anybody who's not in attendance that we can tag? You see how it goes.
Well, we are going to need a chair, so if you, and I'll send that out in an email so that if somebody needs a, you know, 15 minutes to think about it, or if we have people who are not in attendance, they can certainly respond. And we should all be thinking of people that might be good. The membership on the proposal lists types of folks that might be good to participate. And starting at that point, if people could add specific names that they might want to reach out to, that would be good, and we'll finalize this discussion at the next meeting. So in the 10 minutes that are left, if we could look at the interconnection and regionalization proposal. Dave, do you want to talk to that?
Sure. So we didn't share any notes from our meetings, but it was Peter Gallant, Alicia, and Gail Aquina, and myself who had a call and a conversation about this and some emails fleshing out the proposal. It's hopefully pretty straightforward. Everyone should have a copy of that. You sent it out this morning, I believe, Virginia.
Yeah.
This was a topic that was covered in the state water plan. It was a priority topic. It was discussed quite extensively, I would say, by the policy committee of the state water plan. There was a fair degree of consensus at the time on emergency interconnections, not so much on more permanent types of interconnections. But what we're proposing is that we look at interconnections and regionalization, we'll call it sort of in that context, and look at one, obviously the opportunities that it affords, the benefits, you know, system resiliency, the ability to respond to droughts. In some cases, there could be an environmental benefit when you can have more conjunctive use of supplies by sharing resources. There are costs associated with it, not only the infrastructure, but the cost of purchasing water typically. Could be water quality implications. And then on the flip side, there could be environmental impact by moving water across basins and so on. So we do want to look at, you know, what are the policy and regulatory things that are out there that sort of take this into account and are either incentives or impediments to that happening. And how we can, and where there might be opportunities to address these issues, but in a way that I think this is a topic that truly epitomizes sort of the balance that needs to be found that the state water plan talks about. And so we're going to look at consistency with state plans and local plans of conservation development, because sometimes those aren't always in sync, and how that needs to be addressed. What we were very careful when we say in our scope is that we not really get into identifying what specifically where these should be done and prioritizing, because we think that's more the purview of the WOCs and the WOC planning process. And it would be duplicative if we did that. But we might be looking at where there are examples so that people could understand in any recommendation that's made. Here's are the types of things we're talking about. So I guess, you know, just in the interest of time, if there are other people who are a part of that group who want to say anything, or if there are questions on what we're proposing here, we'd be happy to address that.
Are there any questions? If you're trying to ask a question, make sure you're unmuted. I guess there are no questions. Thank you to the subgroup for having put this together. And thanks to the other subgroup that we were talking about just a few moments ago. Do I have anybody who, if in the moment, anybody from the committee who is willing to chair this particular group?
Well, let's, Virginia, before we do that, I want to make sure that the implementation work group as a whole is comfortable with the proposal as written.
Oh, absolutely. Certainly, thank you. I skipped over that.
You know, we might need tweaking here or there. So I'd like people, you know, we're just laying them on this, you know, now, maybe even give people a chance to get back to the entire group and say, you know, why are you doing this? Or I think you need to focus on something a little bit differently. So maybe if we give people, I don't know how long you want, a week or two for people to comment on both topics, I suppose. We want to give people time to really digest it and comment if they feel the need to.
I think that's a good idea, and if this group doesn't have a veto kind of a response to this, I think what you're proposing, David, is a good idea, that we have give people time to think about it, digest it, and see if there are changes that that we would want to propose before actually getting the go-ahead from the Water Planning Council. So,
and we would want to get these, do we have a date for that we would want to get these proposals to the Water Planning Council before the next meeting?
Well, Jack, do you anticipate the July meeting to be happening on the first Tuesday of July?
Yes.
Okay. Well, then I would say that it would be good to have a response back from this group within
a week. Did you hear me say yes?
Yes, I heard you say yes, Jack. Thank you very much.
Okay.
So I think if we got a response back from this group within a week, so that if the two teams that put together these proposals needed to make any adjustments, we could still get it to the Water Planning Council before their meeting, and as close to the full week before as possible would be good. And I would appreciate from the implementation work group members themselves to hear back from everybody. If you don't have any concerns or recommended changes, let me know that so that I'm not waiting to hear from people who aren't going to be responding. So, in other words, give me no's if you don't have any if you don't have any comments. Tell me that. Okay. Any other closing thoughts? In the last 3 minutes of our meeting.
Virginia?
Yes.
This is Judy Allen.
Hi, Judy.
Hi. Is this appropriate time for me to make some comments?
Sure.
First of all, could you repeat the email address for providing info about who I am?
We know who you are, Judy. Don't worry about it.
Oh, okay.
Anybody else? It's daniel.aubin@ct.gov.
Okay. I have concern about the workshop not happening until the spring of 2001 from the Water Efficiency Group. There's a lot of things that could happen between now and then, especially legislatively, with a lot of the issues that they're going to have to be dealing with. So I just want to make sure that whatever happens is timely and thought out. Also, in terms of conservation, there's at least one water utility who is going to have problems with all of this, who are actively providing discounts so that there can be more water consumption, or actively attracting businesses who would be large volume water users. And so that's a piece that I think needs to be considered.
Yes, Judy, we're very well aware of what you're talking about.
Oh, and I'm sure.
the planning group has discussed that with Marianne and her team. And Marianne, if you want to speak briefly to that.
Well, I think what we're going to be talking about are rate structure, good rate structure advice in the workshop. And I know you think it's going to be a little too delayed. There was a considerable discussion about whether we should do it sooner, do it this fall as a virtual workshop. And we are still willing to do that if that's the preference of the group because of the timing issue. But I didn't hear that from you all before. I heard that you wanted to wait. So we're leaving that decision up to you. We're happy to go either way. I do think, though, those issues will still remain in March. They've been going on a long time, so they will still be present in March. And I think there's a benefit from getting everybody together in person. I think there's real synergy that happens with an in-person meeting. And I frankly miss them. I miss, as much as I like seeing all you faces on Zoom, I miss the opportunity to actually meet with you in person. It's just, it makes such a big difference.
Okay. And Judy, we did, the group did talk about trying to time this for earlier in March to try to get this in before the deadlines in the committees and the legislature. But it really, it was a matter of scheduling one of the speakers that was coming in from out of state. So we did have that discussion because I thought it would be important that we have give our legislators an opportunity to hear this discussion before any decisions were made in committee, but that still doesn't preclude them from hearing it before decisions are made in the House and the Senate. So,
and our experience with this is that it probably would take a year for it to percolate anyway, in terms of working these issues through the legislative process. So I would be very surprised if at least some of our recommendations were not to take place in that. If it took place in this particular upcoming session, I would be surprised. I was thinking we would get everything ready for you for the next session if you were so disposed to wanting to submit legislation. But legislators are going to be invited to the workshop. They can certainly come, and you know, there'll be lots of discussion that'll take place there.
This is Judy again. It's not so much delaying that as it is that things might look very different a year from now. And so having the flexibility and an open mind to how all these things we're talking about could look very different in a year, that be something that we just keep in mind.
That's true. Thank you, Judy.
I have one more thing.
Okay.
In terms of the input from the WOCs, they're sort of floating around doing nothing at the moment, but have identified at some point that drought is an issue that they feel strongly about and feel that they should take the lead on. And there seems to be a lot of people looking at drought, and I don't have an answer for all that. Just wanted to put that in there.
Thank you, Judy. And Steve Rupar, that, I don't know if that's something that your topical group has, if that's come up, or if it's something that you might want to look at briefly and give us a sense of where the two, our work and the WOC's work, may be overlapping and how we can coordinate. I know that's a slight change in your direction, but it might make sense to look at it.
So just a comment, I think we have a lot on our plates now. It has not been a focus of our work. We're really focusing on the need for statutory, regulatory strengthening, the use of both targets and restrictions at the state and local level and calibrating that appropriately. And also, you know, whether the plan, current version of the plan would have been effective in 2016, 2017.
Okay,
and we're trying to get that done by November. And I think it's a good comment, but I think we should hold that until we finish our current work.
Okay, I respect that. Thanks for that input. Is there other public comment? Well, hearing none, we are over time and many of us have another meeting at 1:30. I do want to say to those people, it's a different Zoom number for the Water Planning Council Advisory Group meeting that starts at 1:30. So thanks to you all. And I will send out an email summarizing some of the follow-up items that we need to do before our next meeting. Thanks to you all and stay well.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks, everybody.